Republican senators may be running out of options to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act.
This is a red siren moment.
President Trump delivers a blunt message to would-be adversaries.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself.
And Navy brass answering tough questions about sailor safety.
You must do better.
It's time to get caught up in what's happened and what's next. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. Depending on when you hear this, Republicans could be out of options on repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. Friday afternoon, Arizona Republican John McCain announced he could not, in good conscience, vote for the Graham-Cassidy proposal. He wants regular order, hearings, extensive debate on legislation, warning Republicans not to go it alone like Democrats did on health care. His statement this week is very similar to arguments he made before casting the deciding no vote on that so-called skinny repeal bill back in July.
Pass something that will be imperfect, full of compromises, and not very pleasing to implacable partisans on either side, but that might provide workable solutions to problems Americans are struggling with today. What have we to lose by trying to work together to find those solutions?
Kentucky Republican Rand Paul has already said he's a no on the Graham-Cassidy bill, so now there are two on-the-record no votes from Republicans. That's the maximum GOP leaders can afford, assuming all Democrats show up and vote no. So, Graham-Cassidy is not a no-go yet, but its prospects are dim. Maine's Susan Collins is leaning no. She voted no in July. Alaska's Lisa Murkowski did too, and as of Friday afternoon, she was undecided on Graham-Cassidy. So if Collins, Murkowski, or any other Republican senator announces a no vote before you are hearing this podcast, you can skip ahead for the next several minutes or enjoy this recap of how we got here. Just like we saw back in July when a so-called skinny repeal fell a vote short, supporters and opponents of Graham-Cassidy have been mobilizing, both believing it is the last chance to save the nation's healthcare system.
Let me be clear. This is a red siren moment for the entire country. If this bill becomes law, our health care system will be dramatically curtailed, and there will be chaos in many states.
Senate Democrats, led by Chuck Schumer, have rallied health care professionals and parents of special needs children.
Stop playing politics with our children's lives. Stop playing politics with my daughter's life.
Even late night host Jimmy Kimmel has dedicated opening monologues to the bill, questioning Senator Bo Cassidy's commitment to ensure pre-existing conditions are covered under any Republican bill. Cassidy is defending that.
It will increase coverage and it will protect those with pre-existing conditions, particularly for those states who have not had the benefits of Medicaid expansion. We help those in those states.
And President Trump, in a tweet this week, said he would not sign Graham-Cassidy if it did not include coverage of pre-existing conditions. So, what is in the Graham-Cassidy bill? First, it's based on the idea of federalism, transitioning health insurance subsidies and Medicaid spending in the Affordable Care Act to block grants for each state. The bill's sponsors say that's a matter of fairness, complaining about 40% of healthcare spending under Obamacare goes to just a handful of states. We'll talk more about that with our senior Capitol Hill producer Chad Pergram in just a couple of minutes, but for now, let's look at those coverage requirements. The bill proposed by Senators Graham and Cassidy does not expressly change any coverage required under federal law. But what it does do is allow states to apply for waivers from the Secretary of Health and Human Services, basically to make the case for its own insurance requirements. In applying, the provision in the bill says states must show how it intends to maintain access to adequate and affordable health insurance coverage for individuals with pre-existing conditions. Now, that language leaves a lot of open questions, like what kind of arrangements would the federal government allow? What kind of essential health benefits would states ask to waive? And would insurers be permitted to charge more for some pre-existing conditions so long as coverage remained adequate and affordable? The Affordable Care Act lists 10 categories of essential health benefits that must be covered in health plans, like pregnancy services, wellness visits, mental health, and pediatric care. Critics of the Graham Cassidy bill say there's no guarantee coverage requirements won't be cut in states that seek waivers. Those are questions several Republicans say they want answered before casting any vote. So it's clear the odds of Graham Cassidy clearing the Senate have dropped with Senator McCain's announcement and strong indications from Maine's Susan Collins that she is also a no vote. But it does not mean the landscape can't change again quickly. After all, momentum for this latest health care bill picked up intensity very quickly by Capitol Hill standards. That was part of what I spoke about with our senior Capitol Hill producer Chad Pergram earlier this week. The week here has been something to behold because we thought that this health care issue was done and GOP leadership had indicated that they were moving on. It was time for tax reform. Senator Graham, Senator Cassidy roll out their bill with little fanfare. And then I would say within 72 hours, it really was this snowball coming down the mountain.
Jared, we don't talk here at the U.S. Capitol very often about Ridley Scott, the horror director. This is a lot like, from the Democrats' perspective, like Alien. You know, they just keep trying to kill the monster off, and it just keeps coming back. We've seen everything up here this week but Sigourney Weaver. I mean, they just cannot kill this thing off, and that's why they're so concerned, because this bill came out of nowhere.
This Graham Cassidy bill, let's talk a little about what it does and what it doesn't do. One of the big selling points for the sponsors, Lindsey Graham, Bill Cassidy, is it returns to federalism. It creates a block grant system. What is a block grant?
Yeah, and it's funny because you talk about federalism. I looked on the Google searches and like kind of after Brexit last year in England, you know, one of the most searched terms is what is Brexit after people voted? Well, what we're seeing now in the Google searches, one of the most searched terms is federalism. Federalism does not have a lot to do with the federal government. It means the idea that you defer to the states. You send that back to the states. And this is exactly what it is. They take this money that's available for health care, and they say, states, you can go do with it what you want. Now, here's the problem.
To an extent.
Yes, to an extent. And there could be certain things on there. John Kennedy is a Republican senator from Louisiana, and he says, you know, that's great to send money back to the states. He said, governors love, you know, having money. He said, of course they do. Of course, you know, some governors would like this. He said his concern is that maybe California would take this and say, we'll set up our own single-payer health care system. And, of course, conservatives, that's anathema to them. But that's not federalism. You can't say we're going to send it back to the states, but comma. And that's where the but comma part is coming in.
I will say this week, speaking with Senator Graham, he did not seem supportive of this sort of limited federalism.
Federalism can't be on their terms. If California wants to go to single-payer health care plan, let them knock themselves out.
We talk about this money going to the states. A state like California, under this model that's set up in Graham Cassidy, would get a lot less federal health care spending than they get right now.
And so would New York, and so would New Jersey, and so would Ohio.
The reason that some states are going to get less money and other states are going to get more is because it rolls back that Medicaid expansion from the health care law. And so states like Ohio, like California, like New York, like Maryland that expanded Medicaid now— down the road, see less of that money. States like Texas would get a lot more money because they would start dividing this up on more of a population basis than a is Medicaid been expanded basis, right? Is that
yes,
a fair
yes.
reading of it?
Yeah, and that's why Rand Paul, the Republican senator from Kentucky, who was against this Graham Cassidy plan from the beginning, indicated, he said, you know, he doesn't like, you know, certain Medicaid expansion issues. He said, but it looks to him like all they were doing was trying to take stuff from, you know, liberal states and send it to conservative states and kind of stick it to the liberal states. He didn't like that idea at all.
One of the top Democrats, Dick Durbin, talked about that with me this week. Here's a bit of what he said.
Look at Texas. Texas decided we're not going to open up Medicaid. That means fewer people in Texas have an opportunity to get health insurance through Medicaid. No wonder they're getting less money. It was their decision to get less money. They made a conscious decision to do that. Incidentally, they are the biggest winners in the Graham Cassidy bill.
Let's talk about the numbers. You and I spent those hours in the Senate gallery in July. It was one of the more dramatic votes I've ever witnessed on Capitol Hill. Is there any way that Mitch McConnell puts this on the floor if he does not know for sure he has 50 votes, because it was a pretty big embarrassment for Republican leadership in July when they put it on the floor, brought the vice president out, and it fell a vote short.
In one vein, it would be unlikely because of the reasons you state, but nothing happens on Capitol Hill except when they're up against a deadline, and they have a deadline. And so McConnell could try to force the issue. He has said, well, it is his intention to put the bill on the floor and have a vote on this. And again, if that vote doesn't come before, you know, everything turns into a pumpkin, they're in trouble. But you might want to do that to force the issue and say, it's here, guys, it's now or never. This is truly the last train leaving the station.
And show that they did everything they could.
Bingo.
To repeal and replace. All right, we'll watch it next week. Chad Pergram, thanks so much.
Anytime.
Over the summer, two U.S. Navy ships, the USS Fitzgerald and the USS John S. McCain, each collided with much larger cargo vessels in the Pacific Theater. Those two collisions resulted in the deaths of 17 sailors. This week, the Armed Services Committee heard from top naval officials about what is being done to prevent these kinds of accidents. That committee is chaired by Arizona Republican John McCain.
This committee will do everything we can to support the Navy leadership's efforts to course correct. But we must also call you to task and demand answers. As leaders of our Navy, you must do better.
Our Pentagon producer, Lucas Tomlinson, first discussed the issue with us a few weeks ago. He joins the podcast again this week after covering that hearing.
It was a fiery hearing, Jared. You had the newly installed Secretary of the Navy, Richard Spencer. You had the Navy's top officer, Admiral John Richardson. You also had an official from the Government Accountability Office who released a pretty damaging study saying that these Navy warships involved in these recent collisions lacked the necessary safety certifications to be able to do their jobs at sea. In fact, USS Fitzgerald, the warship that collided off the coast of Japan, which drowned seven Navy sailors, had 10 seamanship certifications that had expired at the time of the accident, which raised a lot of red flags. And it was a fiery hearing, Jared. Of course, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator John McCain, one of the warships involved in the collision was named after his grandfather and his father, USS John S. McCain. So this was very personal for the senator that day.
Massachusetts Democrat Elizabeth Warren pressed Admiral Richardson on these certifications. Here is a bit of that exchange.
Of the three, do you know how many had up to date certifications?
I can get you the exact number. There's a number of different certifications, and I'll provide that exact number for the record. But all three of them, because it was pervasive in the forward deployed naval forces.
Do you know offhand how many overseas homeported fleet, how much, what percentage of our overseas homeported fleet currently has expired warfare certifications?
There are just about every ship has some element of their certification expired. And that can be managed if it's one thing and an advanced warfare mission, for instance, you just don't assign them to that mission. Where it becomes troublesome is that if it becomes too many areas, and particularly in those areas that are directly related to safe and effective operation, the fundamentals.
Right.
And so that's when it becomes of great concern.
So, Lucas, the takeaway there is the admiral explained that, yes, there are some expirations with these certifications, but that doesn't mean that the ship and its crew are not fully trained. What is the nuance here in that answer that we heard from the admiral?
Well, Admiral Richardson had a pretty clever answer. He said, just because your driver's license expires doesn't mean you don't know how to drive a car. Richardson, despite all the problems, the lapsed training certifications, Richardson contended that it was an issue with command, meaning it was the skippers of these warships that were responsible for training their crew, training the young officers, and he was saying there was a big breakdown. Jared, he looked back at a decision made in 2003 to close down a six-month school where freshly minted junior officers went to train before reporting aboard their first ships. That school was scrapped, and they sent the junior officers straight to the ships armed with DVDs and CDs to learn their job, do on-the-job training. And Admiral Richardson, in a very candid answer, said that that decision meant that these officers were woefully inadequate to prepare them for the rigors of sea life. Of course, pilots go to flight school. If you want to drive a submarine, go to submarine school. And on-the-job training for a young officer to drive a 9,000-ton warship and fire surface-to-air missiles should not be done underway at sea. That was the admiral's contention. And going back to those certifications, it's noteworthy that because of a lot of maintenance delays, 60% of Navy surface ships were out of commission for over 6,000 days. That's what a government watchdog found. That meant, Jared, that these ships had much less time to train, up to 18 years worth of lost training days, to be exact. So that is one of the reasons that these ships, particularly these four deployed ships, it's not a coincidence, officials say, that these two collisions were involved with Japan-based warships, four deployed ships that are out to sea many times dealing with, of course, this rising North Korean threat. They're dealing with China. The Pacific is a very, very busy place right now, and these ships are spending more time underway, less time training, although many officers I've spoken to, Jared, say that the best time to train is at sea. But clearly, if your sailors are not getting to their schools and doing some of the training they need before going to sea, that's a big problem. And the Secretary of the Navy, Richard Spencer, admitted very candidly when asked by McCain and others what's going on here, he said, we have a problem.
You broke a bit of news the day before this hearing about steps that the Navy has taken in the wake of these two collisions over the summer. Tell me a little bit about what these changes are, what it's going to mean for the Navy moving forward.
Right. Well, Jared, the head of the U.S. Navy Surface Forces, Vice Admiral Tom Roden, sent a message to the fleet instituting some immediate changes in the wake of these two deadly collisions. One of them was every ship in the Navy will now keep their automatic identification system on when transiting busy shipping lanes. And what that system does is alert every ship in the area, not just a warship, but merchant vessels, that a U.S. Navy warship is in the area.
Now, sort of like a transponder in an airplane?
It's exactly what it is, Jared. It's very much like a transponder. It tells all the ships who you are, what you're doing. And as Admiral Richardson pointed out during the hearing when it came up, when he was asked, he said it's not like other merchant ships don't know a U.S. warship is there when you can just look out the window. I mean, these are not stealth aircraft or stealth ships. When you're in a busy shipping lane, everybody should see. And what the most important thing to come out of this decision to keep these automatic identification systems on is it doesn't just alert a merchant vessel, but if a large freighter is on autopilot, that system will actually tell the merchant ship to change course. And these two deadly collisions that happened in June and August both involved deadly collisions with large freighters, merchant ships, and oil tankers, both about three times the size of these two destroyers. So this was an immediate step taken. There were also other steps taken to get the crews more rest. Currently, the Navy stands what it calls, and on many ships, stands what it calls five and dimes, 5 hours on, 10 hours off. But that changes throughout the work week. So one day you might be standing watch, at midnight. The next day you might stand watch in the afternoon. Another part of Rogan's message to the fleet, this admiral's message, was he wants crew members getting more rest and standing the same watch every day. And he also scrapped 5 hour watches. And officials I've spoken to in the Navy say after about 3 hours, you lose your sense of concentration. So they don't want anybody standing watch on a warship or down below decks in the Combat Information Center, which is actually where there's backup navigation. They don't want either of those teams standing more than a 5 hour watch because they'll get tired.
Lucas Tomlinson covers the Pentagon for us. Lucas, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Jared.
President Trump spent much of the week in New York visiting for the first time as U.S. president, a United Nations General Assembly, and delivering some of the most blunt assessments of global threats from someone in his position.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
Our White House correspondent John Decker joins the podcast. And John, I do not believe an American president has ever used nicknames quite like that at a UN address before. It did sound calculated, though. What is the president's team saying about the message that the president delivered?
Well, they're very pleased with the president's speech. If you are a fan of the president, if you are to the right of center, you were very impressed with the message that President Trump delivered directly about North Korea, about Iran, about Venezuela. He was very direct. He was not diplomatic. If you, on the other hand, are to the left of center, you were troubled by the tone, the tenor of the president's speech that he gave to the UN General Assembly. You felt it was undiplomatic, but I think it was President Trump being President Trump.
And he followed it up with a lot more sort of traditional interactions with world leaders, those one-on-one exchanges that we've grown accustomed to seeing over the last several decades. And those seem to be much more by the book for the president.
Absolutely. He began his week on Monday meeting with the French President Emmanuel Macron, expressing how much he really enjoyed his visit to Paris earlier this year, particularly Bastille Day, and said he'd love to have a military parade right down Pennsylvania Avenue on July 4th. We'll see if that happens in 2018. He also met with a number of Mideast leaders, including Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, trying to move the peace process forward. And then, of course, he met with a number of leaders from Asia, trying to hammer home some of those same points that he made during his speech at the UN General Assembly on North Korea.
Let's talk about North Korea, because the president, after he called the North Korean leader Rocket Man and gave a really blunt assessment of sort of the threat that he believes that North Korea poses, followed it up with some action, some new sanctions targeting North Korea, and not just U.S. sanctions. It sounds like some partnerships that the United States has in these sanctions and in this approach.
Perhaps. I say perhaps because it was the president who announced actions that the Chinese government has apparently taken, closing off its banking system to the North Korean government, further isolating North Korea. But we haven't seen an official announcement from China about that. That being said, these sanctions are tougher against North Korea. But what also is interesting here, Jared, is that they are unilateral sanctions. These same sanctions were hoping to be put forward at the UN Security Council. But as you know, there are vetoes that both Russia and China have. And the kind of sanctions that the president announced earlier this week against North Korea simply could not get a unanimous vote at the UN Security Council.
One of the things that has been watched is sort of this relationship the president has with his UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, and some have suggested maybe a closer relationship even with her than he has with his Secretary of State. Was any of that on display this week?
It seems like it. And Nikki Haley had a number of press availabilities. She was actually asked this question: does she want to be Secretary of State? And you can guess her answer. Her answer was no. She likes
can't
the
say
job
yes.
She can't say yes to that kind of question. That being said, it does seem as if the president has a closer relationship with his U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, than he does with his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. That being said, Rex Tillerson was included in that meeting that was held concerning trying to renegotiate that Iran nuclear agreement. He was joined by other foreign ministers. Nikki Haley was present at that. The idea of renegotiating the Iran nuclear agreement is one view held only by the U.S. No other parties that were a part of that deal want to renegotiate the deal with Iran.
And that is something that is going to be fascinating as we move forward, because the president led us to believe that he has made up his mind, but has not shared that even with Secretary of State Tillerson. Did Tillerson say that he was asked by Theresa May what the decision was, and he conceded he didn't know?
That's correct. And Theresa May, I believe, asked President Trump directly what his decision will be, and President Trump told her no. He would not disclose what he's thinking there. But it seemed, just based upon the things that he was saying, the things that President Trump was saying, that as if he's leaning towards pulling the U.S. out of the treaty, trying to push for a renegotiation. The president, as you know, as a candidate, as president, has called
The Iran nuclear deal, the worst deal ever negotiated by the U.S., says it's bad for the U.S., and it's bad for the region. It's bad for the world. So this is a move that the president may be taking post UN General Assembly.
A lot to watch as we get closer to that deadline. John Decker will cover it for us at the White House. Thanks, John.
Thanks a lot, Jared.
And that will do it for this edition of the From Washington podcast. There's an election next week. Luther Strange, the Alabama Republican appointed to fill the vacancy left by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, wants that Senate job full time. But he's facing a tough primary from former Judge Roy Moore. President Trump is backing Big Luther, as he's called. Strange is also the choice of Republican leadership here in D.C. Moore, however, has the backing of a lot of conservative activists, like former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. It's a race worth watching. And of course, we'll also see what happens with the Graham Cassidy healthcare proposal. You can now subscribe to the From Washington podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you like what we're doing, please consider that option to help us out. As always, stay tuned to your Fox News Radio affiliate and our social media pages on Twitter and Facebook for all the latest stories both in and out of Washington. And for all of us at Fox News Radio, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.